I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is Prince Rupert, British Columbia. The City of Rainbows, as it is known, has a long and rich history that is the subject of a new book by Blair Muro with the very apt title of The City of Rainbows, A Colorful History of Prince Rupert. And the book is very much about the city itself and goes from pre-European contact all the way up into the 21st century. It's an interesting profile of Prince Rupert, British Columbia, given its location and how isolated geographically it is from the rest of the country. It has a history that is extremely distinct. And yet, this particular local history touches on major themes that exist in communities all across Canada. Everything from questions associated with colonialism, economic developments, climate change, and just building local cultures. And while nobody would read this book and suggest at all that it isn't very specific to the circumstances of Prince Rupert, as I mentioned, given the geographic realities, the provincial type culture that exists within Prince Rupert comes across very clearly. But as you read the book, it's clear that the reality of life in Prince Rupert, the challenges that were faced and overcome by the communities that have been there for a very long time, a lot of those questions, a lot of those themes speak to much broader issues. And so when I had the opportunity to speak with Blair Muro about the book and about some of these broader issues, I was very much looking forward to it. And it was a wonderful chat. Blair is clearly very passionate. Born and raised in Prince Rupert, he clearly loves the city. But as he says, it's not a completely uncritical look of the town and its development. So I was thrilled with the chance to speak with them, and very pleased with how this one turned out. I think you will enjoy it as well. So let's get right into my chat with Blair Muro. All right. And Blair Muro joins me now. Blair, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Sean. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have you here to talk about The City of Rainbows, A Colorful History of Prince Rupert. Let's start from the beginning and why you wanted to write this book. You get into it in the introduction. It's clear that you are very proud of your town, very proud of the community where you grew up and where you currently live. But what made you want to go back and write a history of the city?
It sounds kind of funny, but it didn't actually start as a book. What I started writing was actually a pamphlet, for lack of a better word. The city was going through a rebranding exercise in 2019. And I heard all of these different ideas that sounded so generic and so boring and didn't really inspire anything. And out of nowhere, I picked up another history book in Prince Rupert. It was published in 1982, and it was called The City of Rainbows. And I read through and I just went, you know what, that actually does provide a little bit of inspiration. And it is a compelling kind of a timeless metaphor. Why don't I just try to say we should rebrand Prince Rupert, or I guess re-rebrand Prince Rupert as the City of Rainbows. And so I tried to convince the mayor to get on board. I wrote him a 7-page pitch or an argument on why I thought it was the perfect metaphor, the perfect brand. And then he jumped on my team and has been by my side trying to promote this ever since. And we got the rest of council on board. We were able to hire a Simpson artist to help with the City of Prince Rupert's rebrand. And I just kept on fleshing out this argument more and more and more. And then the pandemic hit. So in 2020 and 2021, I had a lot more free time on my hands. And I just basically asked the question, how much farther back in history can this metaphor extend? And the person I would give actually the most credit to is Dr. Charles Menzies, was kind enough to take some time out of his day. He's an anthropologist who hails from Gitgatha. And I said, can I apply this metaphor all the way back pre-European arrival? And he immediately jumped. He saw exactly what I was aiming at as far as multicultural trade, the exchange of cultures, the exchange of languages. And he was a huge encouragement for me to try to extend this metaphor way farther than I thought it could ever go.
So let's get into a little bit about that part of it, the geography of the city and how that plays into this. Obviously, to have rainbows, you need rain. And you talk in the book about how much rain the city gets. But in terms of the metaphor side of it, the multicultural side of it, the point of trade, all those things that come into it, how important is the city's geography, just physically where it is? Does that play into it? And has it always played into it for the people who have lived there for thousands of years?
I mean, it's the number one rule of real estate: location, location, location. The city of Prince Rupert wouldn't exist today without its very strategic location. And even again, pre-European arrival, I mean, if you just look at the geography of where Cayon Island is situated, just south of the mouth of the Nass River and just north of the mouth of the Skeena River, two of the most important rivers in the entire province of British Columbia, both with huge salmon runs. I mean, halibut, this used to be called the halibut capital of the world for a reason, because there's huge banks out there with massive halibut. Rock cod, I mean, you name the type of species and they are right on our shores. So yeah, location has been, it's the reason we were chosen for the terminus of the Grand Trunk Railway. It's the reason we were chosen for, you know, a modern container port. The same strategic advantages that existed pre-European arrival for defense and trade and everything else. There's a reason that the Europeans had their eyes on it once they arrived.
Now, before the Europeans arrived there, and the book gets into a number of people who were coming through the area, how important it was, as you say, economically, strategically, culturally. In terms of doing the research for that, given that there was such a diverse group of people and so many people came through the area, how did you undertake that process in trying to assess its significance? And who did you reach out to, and what was the process for the pre-European contact part of this book?
Well, I had a pretty simple question, simple in the way that you ask it, but completely profound based on the litany of answers that I got, which was, how did we get where we are today? Mm. And so something as simple as, why is British Columbia part of Canada and not the United States? That takes you all the way back to the original gold rushes and how the kind of initial colonial government kind of asserted itself at that time against the influx of Americans. But extending even farther back, the amount of anthropological research that's been done in archaeology in this region, there's quite a lot of archaeologists that claim that this is one of the, I think they called it the North Coast Interaction Sphere, because there was just so much going on that when they do some of these digs, it's actually been identified as being artifact rich. And there's a very good reason for that, is because the Tsimshian, the Niska, the Haida, the Heltsuk, the Tlingit, all these different peoples, they have been here for 10 plus thousand years, exercising their rights, their culture, their economy. And so the archaeological record is way bigger than I think most people realize. And even for me, being born and raised here, it's not really taught in the schools, just what was happening here pre-colonization. So that to me was a massive start, was getting into all the archaeological and anthropological research. And then beyond that, it's actually just picking up the phone and calling people whose names are listed. That was also a huge help. And then there's a lot of authoritative sources who have done a lot of work around basically oral histories. And they're called oral histories for a reason. They're not written down for the most part. There's a lot of research that was done by Franz Boas and a few local interpreters back around the turn of the century to try to document some of those stories. It's not my place to tell them, and I don't try to kind of copy and paste those stories. But anytime there was a gap in the archaeological record, you could try to find examples of stories that people had of why migration patterns might have shifted in a particular season, or the types of conflicts that might have happened with neighboring nations, things of that nature.
And when you're doing that, though, that there could potentially be a conflict between the physical, the archaeology, and then the oral history. Did you have any examples of that, where there were still gaps or potentially conflicts, and trying to navigate those spaces that, especially when you have a case, say, of an artifact that says something, an oral tradition that says another, or potentially two oral traditions that say different things, given that there are diverse people in the region? Like, did you have situations like that where you're trying to navigate, not necessarily areas where there's conflict, but potentially conflicting information or stories?
I wouldn't say I encountered anything of, well, but maybe I should start with this, is when you're trying to write you know, the history of one specific island for 10,000 plus years. It feels like a rock skipping off the top of the surface of the water. You can't go into the depth that you want in order to tell the breadth of the story. So there was plenty of rabbit holes I would have loved to go down that would have kind of tried to flesh out those things. On a higher level, though, the most interesting thing that I encountered to your question was, clearly archaeology could not explain the reason for a period of sustained intense conflict. You can document it. You can see, you know, evidence of forearm breaks or skull breaks and things that would identify that there was war, but you would never have any idea why that would have occurred in the first place or why different village settlements would have shifted locations. And that's where a lot of these authoritative sources on these oral histories was very enlightening to see that you could clearly explain that when the Tlingit invaded from the north, that created a very strategic defense system between a lot of the groups that were down here. And that, to me, again, not taught in local schools, but was so fascinating to read of from more authoritative sources than myself, that when you're skipping that rock across the surface to tell a really high-level story, the most important thing to know in Cayan Islands context is it was not some uninhabited, you know, rainforest before it was the city of Prince Rupert. It actually has tens of thousands of years of really fascinating human habitation, cultural development, multicultural trade. It, to me, it's, that's the biggest thing I hope people take from this book, is just the category of prehistory. And to me, is fake. The idea that somehow history only starts when, you know, the Europeans showed up on Pacific shores, that to me is faulty. And that's what I was directly trying to confront.
In terms of the why, what were some of the answers? Because you could imagine with all the resources that are there, that's what immediately strikes me. I mean, people fight about resources all the time around the world. This is still going on, that we fight about resources. Was that one of the main points of conflict when you're going back and looking at the periods of war pre-contact?
It's where I'm probably not the guy you want to ask that question to. I didn't go into that level of depth.
Yeah.
But it, like, I mean, if you're really curious about this stuff, that if you look in the footnotes of my book on some of the folks that I've cited on that stuff, they've gone into substantially more detail than I thought ever existed on paper. And they can answer that question better than I can.
Fair enough. Now, you talk about in the book, and as we've talked here, about wanting to kind of change the narrative or confront the narrative of history starts once Europeans arrive, and what you learned in school and all the stuff that you didn't learn in school. And the book gets into the idea of the pioneers, the heroic pioneers show up and they tame the land and history starts and everything's great. From that point, is that what you learned? And even just around Prince Rupert in the time that you were growing up and your time working there, what are the like historical landmarks, like historical plaques, the things that in the public realm, like, is that really the dominant narrative that people are taught about the town?
Yes, unfortunately. A lot of the times the history of Prince Rupert starts in, I think, whatever it was, 1905 or 1906, when the first railway surveyors came and started to basically hack down some of the coastal rainforest to make way for the Grand Trunk Pacific. That's where a lot of the narrative starts.
Just in terms of what you learned in school, what's around the town, public history-wise, plaques, statues, those sorts of things. What are people being taught about the city's history?
Well, a lot of the times it really does come down to, without the Grand Trunk Pacific Railway and the vision of Charles Hayes, that the city of Prince Rupert wouldn't exist as it does today. And I do kind of concede that there is a lot of truth to that, because without the railway, yes, you would not have the Asia Pacific port. And that is basically the future of Prince Rupert. But as far as plaques and what we're taught in school, it does, a lot of it comes back to Charles Hayes being the founding father of Prince Rupert. There's a statue next to City Hall of him. It's where the high school is named after. The largest mountain on Cayan Island is named after him. There's a creek named after him. There's a lagoon. I mean, just about anything you can think of has the name Hayes attached to it, a street name as well. So, I mean, he is iconic in Prince Rupert's history. And I basically make the case that, yes, he is the founding father. He was the railway magnet that brought the Grand Trunk Pacific, but you cannot ignore the influence of Mother Nature, the strategic location that was set there for thousands of years and had been proven by all the indigenous nations in the area and their extensive trade networks. But also what you can't ignore is everyone that came after Charles Hayes really made this city into what it is today. Mm-hmm. He wanted to build a city that basically, he hired his son-in-law, who was part of the Breton Hall firm, to design this grandiose city beautiful movement type of city, completely ignoring the topography of Cane Island, and took so much blasting of rock and just like in no way that made any sense to the way that the hills and Muskeg were all organized. So there is a really interesting pioneer story of guys having to get shipped in here to cut down rainforest, to dig out stumps, to deal with Muskeg, to have all this mud coming over their rain boots as they're basically hacking down this rainforest. It was a story of initiative and grit and tenacity. But partly because Charles Hayes basically said, we are going to build a city where industry comes first. We want this port and this railway is absolute paramount importance. The city center, the city design comes secondary to the needs of the Grand Trunk Railway. And so if you superimposed an aerial shot of Prince Rupert today over the original Breton Hall town plan, it looks almost identical. There are very few exceptions to that. So we are directly living with those decisions that were made at the turn of the century.
Now, just for anyone who doesn't know, you've obviously said that Charles Hayes was, you know, railway magnate, very powerful guy, but he also died on the Titanic.
He did.
I'm curious for you, does that hold any allure to his story? There's a certain romantic notion of the Titanic at this point, and the fact that there's a story in Ottawa too. I don't think it's Charles Hayes, but it could be. But another railway guy who died and all of his stuff made it to the Chateau Laurier, and now that's part of the go. Okay, so it is Charles Hayes. So his stuff, and now the Chateau Laurier is haunted by him and his stuff.
Yes. Right?
Like, so there's these romantic stories about the Titanic that exist. Does that play into the lore that Charles Hayes has locally at all?
100%. Absolutely. It sounds a little bit like hyperbole, but the Titanic is almost talked about like a local shipwreck. Which is very strange being on the other side of the continent. But a lot of people, there was all the headlines when Charles Hayes went down on the Titanic were the dreams of Prince Rupert went down with him. Hmm. You know, that the plans he had for the city were in his back pocket and went to the bottom of the ocean alongside him. And there was this kind of unquestioned narrative that after he passed away, that it was a direct result of his death that Prince Rupert never realized the potential that he had been promoting. But based on, it's not just my research, but plenty of other people have done very detailed research to know that the Grand Trunk Pacific was making ridiculous forecasts that were trying to sell people on, particularly on land sales, because they wanted land speculation to drive up values, increase their return on investment and build more railway, fund things like the Chateau Laurier. And there was originally going to be a Chateau Prince Rupert, which was going to rival its grandeur here in the city. Never built, obviously. But some of his forecasts were so outlandish that it's almost as if the best way to describe it is he created this impossible prophecy out of his propaganda. So instead of the narrative that I'm trying to shift for people is that it's not that the dreams of Prince Rupert died alongside Charles Hayes on the Titanic. It's just that we need to learn that everything that he was promoting was unrealistic in the first place. So what we need to do is set our own dreams, our own ambitions based on what we are capable of. So that to me is the unrealized potential, is we need to shed off the expectations that we're going to be another San Francisco or another Vancouver and really just embrace what we are, which is we're a rural and remote community, you know, basically a stone's throw from the Alaskan panhandle. And we should be proud of that fact.
I mean, all these guys did that, right? They were all talking up everything. Everything was going to be the greatest thing ever, right? To a certain extent, some of them were just snake oil salesmen, and they made a lot of money doing it. But when we look at Prince Rupert, and you talk about this in the book, that early 20th century period, so many Europeans are coming, and it seems to me that it's not all for one reason, that there's a lot of different things that are drawing people out to the region, that you do have obviously the railway, but you also have other forms of industry and things that are going on in the city. So how do you kind of think of that era, maybe interwar period, 20s and 30s, where the city is going from that initial vision, Charles Hayes has died, First World War is over, all the upheaval that is associated with that. And it seems to me, as going through it, this is kind of the city almost finding its modern self in a way. But how do you situate that era?
In going back to the original simplicity of my question, which was how did we get here? One of the things that's impossible to overlook in Prince Rupert's context is how multicultural this city is. And I wanted to trace back those origins. And so the railway definitely brought in people from all walks of life, like Europeans and non-Europeans. There was, you know, a significant Chinese labor population, Japanese services as well, and business owners and fishermen. The commercial canning industry brought in a whole bunch of Asian labor as well. And so that kind of built the foundation, so to speak, of Prince Rupert's multiculturalism. But then kind of beyond that, just like you had mentioned, the war shipped a lot of people back off right when the railway was done. First World War hits, you know, locals get shipped off to war. They come back and it's kind of this malaise, which I think was customary across a lot of the country. The Depression was, I think, a little less harsh in Prince Rupert than most other places because you have such an abundant food supply right on your doorstep in the North Pacific Ocean. But it was really World War II. That was where it's a literal invasion, as I said in my book, an invasion of American troops into Prince Rupert, where the city goes from 6,000 to 20,000 people in a very short period of time, building massive defenses, because the fear on the Pacific at that time was there had been so many Japanese fishermen who had built up quite a lot of local knowledge that they were worried that that information would make it back to the Japanese powers that be and that the Skeena would be a point of invasion. So they even, one of the best kept secrets of the war was a local armored train that went up and down the Skeena in the Second World War. So it shows the type of fear that people had at that time. And so there was significant resources invested in Prince Rupert, and a lot of the footprint, you know, massive structures that were built post-war were peacetime conversions into things that we still actually, that we know of today, modern assets in Prince Rupert. One of the most important is Watson Island, which I do a big piece on Watson Island, which is essentially built as a munitions factory, munitions export. So during the Second World War, like bombs of all kinds being shipped to the Aleutian Islands and to the Asia Pacific War Theater were going through Watson Island. It was the biggest peacetime conversion post-war into a pulp mill. And that pulp mill brought that next wave of migration to Prince Rupert. It at one point employed almost, I think, 20% of the city of Prince Rupert. And so that's where you had a big influx of Italian immigrants as well. New sawmill was built to kind of supply, to be that tertiary spinoff industry, which attracted a lot of folks from the Punjabi region in India. And so it was a fascinating look into, to me, that post-war resettlement was just a new wave of migration of increased multiculturalism.
So in that realm, we get to the mid part of the 20th century, into the second half of the 20th century. And in the book, I think this is kind of an interesting way that it's framed. And from between chapters 11 and 15, you go, here comes the boom, the bubble, the bust, and yes, the recovery. So it really kind of, through the titles of those chapters, you get a sense of what's happening in the city through the second half of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But for you, in going through this, now this is a point where you talked about oral history earlier, but now you have living memory of this, this era. So you had the opportunity to go talk to people who had lived through these periods, who lived through all this, the boom, the bust, and now the recovery. What was your approach to this era where you have living memory when you compare it to the era where you're going through archaeology and oral histories, oral testimonies? Yes. And how do you approach very different temporal periods with different access to the sources?
That's another fantastic question. I've never been asked that before. My process, I don't know if other authors have done this. I went straight to the newspaper archives and I made it my goal to read every single front page of every newspaper ever produced on Kaan Island.
Wow.
And the Prince Rupert Daily News is the most prolific. And so some of it's online, which was helpful, but about 50 years are all on microfilm, which is like old school. I have to go into the library in person, attach the microfilm to the microfilm reader, go through it. And so I read every single front page. In my head, it was like, if it's important enough at that time to make the front page, it's important enough to at least hopefully make this book. Mm-hmm. And so I just took really detailed notes, and I actually didn't, I hardly talked to anyone during that process of reading every single newspaper, because I wanted to kind of create this chronology of, at least now, from my perspective, what's the most interesting or influential or notable types of developments that hit the front page at some point in history, that then I can at least write down this narrative arc and then go and ask people who may have lived it, how they kind of internalized it. And that was, in hindsight, such a great process, because I had access to, I mean, the newspapers, they always say, are the first draft of history. Mm. All I took as notes was, you know, this event on this date, maybe this is how it ties into a larger, you know, metaphorical, symbolic narrative piece. But then interviewing a whole bunch of people who were involved was so interesting, and sometimes hit very, very close to home. And I can give you one very specific example, was the Alaska ferry blockade. Basically, a whole bunch of fishermen had been really quite upset with the way that the Pacific Salmon Treaty with the United States had been renegotiated, or I guess failed to. And they basically blockaded in an Alaska ferry into the dock. And it made international headlines after one of them got caught lighting an American flag on fire, which just like set off this massive firestorm. Oh. And as I'm doing all this research, there's a couple of books written about it, and I see my grandfather's name. And so I was like, oh my gosh, okay, I have to pick up the phone and call him. And it was so interesting getting his firsthand perspective, where my dad also followed in his footsteps in the seafood industry. So I could interview both my grandfather and my dad about their own experience, which was exactly opposite. They both remembered it completely differently, which gave me so much more nuance and perspective to then go and ask questions of others. And all that comes from, for me, because the Alaska ferry blockade happened when I was still a child, I don't really have any memory of it. I remember the photo on the front page, and I remember a little bit of the angst. But beyond that, it's like, all it was a headline.
Right.
So that was a super interesting example for me, to just go from the newspaper headline. I can see how that fits into the larger narrative around fisheries, of they went from a boom to there was a bit of a bubble to restructuring and a bust, how that all ties together. But then to get the firsthand experiences from people of my own family, to then go out into the world and ask people who were involved, I think it made the product so much better than it could have been me just reading old newspapers.
Right. Yeah. And did the people you talked to, because you mentioned this with the 1930s, that again, because of the geography, Prince Rupert was somewhat insulated from some of the Depression. There's a food source right there. And we associate so much of the imagery of the Depression with the Dust Bowl, which not as so much an issue in Prince Rupert as much as elsewhere, obviously. And with that, I'm curious too about the second half of the 20th century, Cold War. You have this perception for your father and your grandfather of the incident they're involved in, but given the proximity to Alaska and to Russia, was there an experience of the Cold War that was different from the way maybe it exists elsewhere in the narratives? Or did people talk about the 20th century or the second half of the 20th century in a way that might have surprised you from a cultural or political perspective?
I don't actually think that I encountered much as far as local narratives around the Cold War. I mean, it's obviously, it hit the local media all the time about updates on what was happening. Anything from the Cuban Missile Crisis to the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was always, you know, extensive local media coverage. But as far as how it impacted people on the ground in Prince Rupert, I don't think there was anything that caught my eye enough that actually made the book to reference what was happening in the Cold War, aside from, I guess, the immediate post-war period. There's this massive, like, it's almost this feeling of human emancipation that, you know, after the Second World War, where, and again, I repeat it after the Berlin Wall, of just like the peacetime dividend, right? That this is the end of history and the end of war. And obviously, that proves not to be true. But in both cases, for Prince Rupert, it's actually interesting to look at what was happening in that initial resettlement, because, you know, NATO is established and the United Nations and everything post-Second World War. Prince Rupert locally gets its first female mayor, who makes this great claim. She said that, you know, England had its greatest periods of expansion and growth and harmony under female monarchs. Hopefully the same holds true for Rupert. That was such a cool little bookend to highlight there.
Yeah.
Same thing, the early 90s is basically, in my kind of narrative, was the end of the bubble. So people's spirits are still quite high. This is like the streets are paved with gold. Fishing is booming. Pulp mill is booming. This town had so many more amenities than any other city of its size. But then it all flips on its head as soon as the kind of the early 90s hit. So yeah, I can't say I can think of anything specific that was happening internationally aside from the mood, I guess, right. That might be synonymous.
Yeah. And because it does seem like in going through the book that certainly in the economic side of things, Prince Rupert isn't really following, again, the dominant narratives that you read about that's happening elsewhere in the country and elsewhere in North America, that it is kind of insular in its own little economy, the own culture, and that it's really the local forces that are driving things. And again, the national narratives, the national trends aren't hitting in Prince Rupert quite in the same way as we see elsewhere in the country. And does that just kind of speak to, and I mean this in the nicest way, I don't mean this because it gets used in a derogatory way, does it speak a little to maybe the provincial nature of Prince Rupert in some way, that it's almost self-sustaining community that can operate independent of wider trends?
If you asked me that question in 1989, I would say absolutely. But based on the experience of what's happened in the 90s, which we're still recovering from, Prince Rupert over the decades has opened itself up more and more and more to the international import-export economy. And what that means is less and less local influence and control over our own destiny. So when there's a massive, you know, if we ever had a Dust Bowl incident again in the prairies, Prince Rupert will feel that because our grain elevator will end up having to cut jobs and right. You know, lose output. If there was any ever significant issues, say with metallurgical coal being used for steel and significant worldwide restrictions put on coal mining, Prince Rupert would feel that as well because we've got a coal terminal exporting. You know, if there's big changes to the salmon treaties with the Americans or Halibut Commission or things like that, Prince Rupert will feel it. And a lot of those decisions are increasingly being made in Victoria and Ottawa. So the farther Prince Rupert has kind of gone into the international export economy, I think the less insular we are able to be. So the experience in the 90s was essentially, I called it the turmoil trifecta, as you had fishing being completely restructured and half of licenses wiped out within just a few years. Forestry, massive restructuring, the closure of the pulp mill, huge regional implications, not just for timber harvesters, but locally for hundreds, if not over 1,000 pulp mill workers, at the same time that the port goes through some of its most trying times and almost declares bankruptcy. All three of those things are factors of massive international negotiations, particularly with the United States, and there wasn't a whole bunch of local influence that really could be had on any of those individual factors. So I think we're less insular by design as the decades go on.
And another thing that, of course, is influencing the town and the community is climate change and changes to certainly salmon runs and other factors. And we were talking just before we started to record, it's very hot in the West right now. Yes. Not brutal in Prince Rupert as it is in other parts of British Columbia, but still, these are factors, and fires are increasingly common in the West. So there are things that are changing that is certainly beyond the control of Prince Rupert, but it's something that has to be dealt with. And at the end of the book, you do talk about and you get into what's next and where is the city going? And how do you situate Prince Rupert now? And what is the future hold? I get the sense that you're very optimistic, that you obviously love the town and you see very positive, great things for the future, but it all does happen within this now international sphere, economically, politically, culturally, environmentally, that locally there's minimum control over. So how do you try to situate the town within now this larger setting of things that, as you say, don't really have that much control over all the time?
When I go back to what are the things that are very unlikely to change over the years, obviously location is not going to change.
Right.
So our economy will always, no matter what, be somewhat based on Asia-Pacific trade. There's no way around that. And so we are going to live with the boom and bust of how that goes. But environmentally speaking, yeah, it's interesting bringing up that heat wave. I actually think Prince Rupert is uniquely positioned in a strange way to welcome climate refugees. And that might be strange language for people to hear in Canada. But what we've seen in the summer months, you know, the hottest Prince Rupert has ever gotten on record is just barely beyond 30 degrees. And it has only happened once. The longest we've ever gone without rain, I think the record was like 3 weeks straight without precipitation. Other parts of the world would kill for that type of weather. It does take a bit of grit and tenacity to live in the rainiest and cloudiest city in Canada, but the benefits of that is when there's massive wildfire season burning all over the province and there's smoke, and you talk about the issues of, you know, even just basic lung health and having to inhale wildfire smoke, sometimes from fires thousands of kilometers away. That doesn't happen in Prince Rupert because we are right on the doorstep of the North Pacific Ocean. We have the mountains, the big coastal Rockies right behind us. So our air quality, in my opinion, is second to none. Abundant access to fresh water, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, environmentally speaking, I think Prince Rupert is poised to become increasingly important as the world's environment changes. And I don't say that lightly because there's some places that I know it will be devastating. And it will ruin certain people's way of life. Prince Rupert, though, is strategically located to, I think, if you wanted to talk about earthquakes, you know, there's been some interesting studies that Prince Rupert is not as vulnerable as other places on the Pacific shelf. There was this big study done around tsunamis, which basically said you might have, you know, a couple of low-lying areas that might have some issues with a surge tide, but, you know, Prince Rupert's lucky enough to be protected by a gigantic island right outside of our inner harbor. So that's low risk as well. Wildfire is very unlikely to happen in a coastal rainforest. I mean, you name it, Prince Rupert is I don't want to say sitting pretty, but I think relatively speaking or comparably speaking, Prince Rupert is looking good as far as the changing climate goes.
We'll wrap up with this because I feel like we've been very positive about the city, and I think rightfully so. I've never been, but everyone who has been says it's lovely and a wonderful place to visit, and the locals are seem very positive about it. But you're very clear in the book that this isn't necessarily a love letter to Prince Rupert, that you're going to get into the city, its history, warts and all, because no place is perfect. That doesn't exist. So in trying to do that, while also being very proud of your town and where you grew up and being optimistic about the future, how do you try to assess those warts, those problems, the issues that any place has? And how do you try to bring those up in the history of the book while also trying to kind of maintain this narrative structure that you have?
I don't know if this was conscious or unconscious, but thinking of all of those warts, as you say, that I wanted to highlight, I didn't just choose a scab to pick at a scab and go at old wounds. That was not my philosophy. I really wanted to basically highlight those either problematic, concerning, whatever types of issues that could be viewed as a potential negative, rather than gloss over them, which a lot of other kind of these pioneer narratives had done. By confronting them head on, I basically want to give permission to people to learn a lesson from history that we can apply moving forward. So when I look at all the different scabs that I picked at, it was all for the purpose, ultimately, of healing and learning, because I don't want Prince Rupert to repeat the mistakes of the past. That's my own personal self-interest. I still live here. I'm born and raised here. My kids are going to be the you know, I think the fourth generation of my family to call this place home. I want them to choose to stay here. I am self-interested in wanting to learn the lessons of the past. And one of the biggest ones, particularly in the last couple of decades, is you need to be prepared for boom and bust. It's inevitable. You cannot have on these rose-colored glasses all the time to think that things are always going to get better. For the lack of sounding, I have no other, you know, this is going to sound so corny, and I apologize, but you have to plan for a rainy day. The only thing I can think to say is you can't always think that the next day is going to be sunnier than the day before. And Prince Rupert's been guilty of that a lot, that when times are starting to get tough, instead of saying, okay, let's start that rainy day fund, or, you know, try to protect or insulate ourselves from, you know, some impending changes, by and large, a lot of decision makers over the history have said things will always get better. We just need to weather the storm, so to speak. But you have no idea how long a storm is going to last. Yep. So being prepared for those inevitable downturns in particularly a resource economy is absolutely necessary. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. And also a reason for people who aren't in Prince Rupert or aren't familiar with Prince Rupert to read the book, because while this is, of course, a book about Prince Rupert, a lot of the themes that emerge, especially, as you say, in a resource community, the boom, the bust, the cycles, the certainly at the start when you're talking about settler colonialism and the impact of that, like these lessons apply elsewhere in the country. This isn't, again, it's a book about Prince Rupert. I don't want to give anyone the impression it's not a book about Prince Rupert, because it clearly is, but there are themes and trends that emerge that are relevant to other communities all across the country, from coast to coast to coast, is how I would assess it. I don't know if you wrote that in mind.
Yeah, no, it's really funny you say that, because I actually, what I tried to do in the last chapter was say the lessons that we can take from Prince Rupert's history are lessons that can be applied to bettering human nature and the human condition. I was really trying to, like, what is, if someone picks up this book because they've just immigrated from India or Vietnam or somewhere in Europe or whatever, if they pick up this book and read it, I want them to be able to understand by the end that there is a very unique spirit to this community. That's the best way to say it. It's like you need to have this like kind of demented sense of optimism through the most unfavorable circumstances. That's the only way I can describe it. And so my conclusion is essentially the story of Prince Rupert and the story of the people of Prince Rupert is actually a very interesting litmus test for the human condition and how we respond to trials and tribulations. So even for someone who's never heard of Prince Rupert, who's never been here, who doesn't know anyone from Prince Rupert, I hope they could pick that up, read it cover to cover, and actually say, wow, okay, I can apply some of these lessons in my own life to avoid some of the mistakes made in this community.
And yeah, we would definitely encourage everybody to do it. So again, the book is The City of Rainbows, A Colorful History of Prince Rupert. Blair, if people want to pick up the book or keep tabs of everything going on in the city and the stuff you got going on, you're a really busy guy out there with the bio that's attached to the book. Everyone could look at everything you got going on, but if people want to keep tabs on you and the town and the book, what's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, great question. Well, so the book is available through Heritage House, so they've got a wide distribution network. So if anyone wanted to get it online, of course, the big guys like Amazon have it available. But I would say support your independent local bookstore first, if you can, to place that order. And then as far as myself, I don't know what the next project holds, but if anyone actually did want to follow what we're up to here in Prince Rupert, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and on, it's called X now, formerly Twitter. Feel free to look me up and see some of the projects that we've got on the go.
All right, and we will link to all that in the show notes below, so be sure to check it out. Again, The City of Rainbows, A Colorful History of Prince Rupert. Blair Miro, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean. This was great.
And there you have it, my chat with Blair Miro. I thank him for his time. And again, the book is The City of Rainbows, A Colorful History of Prince Rupert. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the Canadian Press, and I'm using the CBC's published version from the Canadian Press, entitled Prince Rupert Port to Get Busier with $1.35 billion gas export plant. And the story profiles how Alta Gas Limited, which is based in Calgary, is partnering with Royal Vopak, a Dutch venture partner, to approve a final investment for a large-scale liquefied petroleum gas and bulk liquids terminal near Prince Rupert. Now, this final decision came after a lengthy environmental review of 5 years, and the Prince Rupert Port Authority is quoted in the story as being very excited for this final investment, calling it a milestone for the Port of Prince Rupert as it marks the largest investment in the port's history. And this article, while it is pretty short and just gives kind of the tombstone information associated with this investment, it speaks to what Blair was talking about at the end of our chat of how Prince Rupert is very much now part of this global economy, that if there was a economic downturn like we saw in the 1930s that was coupled with another environmental catastrophe similar to the Dust Bowl, that Prince Rupert would not be as insulated now as it was back then. And this investment, this $1.35 billion investment, speaks to that, have how Prince Rupert has become more and more integrated within the global economy and global trade system. So the investment that we see here to increase the number of barrels of liquefied petroleum and just to increase that through the investment really highlights the growth of Prince Rupert that Blair tracks throughout the book. So today's historical headline of the week from the Canadian Press, Prince Rupert port to get busier with $1.35 billion gas export plan. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your shows, likes, rates, comments, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. If you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old is news at gmail.com, and head on over to activehistory.ca. All the great written material over there on the website. Wonderful piece earlier this week on the relevance of historians in 2024. Really a fascinating profile there. So I recommend that. And really, if you go into the search bar on the website, you can find something on a lot of topics from Canadian history. So be sure to check it out over there on activehistory.ca. As I mentioned last week, we got a lot of great episodes already recorded and starting to put together some new interviews. So I'm very excited about those. But as I say, if you want to let me know what you would like to hear, do feel free to reach out. So with that, I will say thanks again for listening, everybody. And we'll be back with you again next Wednesday for more What's Old Is News.